From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. NPR's Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep has reported from Pakistan many times, and his new book explores life and death in one sprawling Pakistani city, Karachi. It's reporting as archaeology, as Inskeep peels back the layers of a city that has mushroomed almost beyond imagination, increasing its population 30-fold in the past 65 years. Inskeep chronicles Karachi's past and present and the cross-currents that continue to push its evolution. The book is called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Steve Inskeep joins us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. NPR Steve Inskeep has reported from Pakistan many times, so it's not surprising that that country is the subject of his new book. What's surprising, perhaps, is that the book is not an exploration of U.S.-Pakistani relations or Pakistani's role in fighting terrorism. Instead, it's a book about the life and times of one city, Karachi. Inskeep calls Karachi an instant city. Its population has grown 30-fold since the end of World War II, from about 400,000 to its present population of 13 million. The book profiles the everyday aspirations of families in Karachi who must contend with ethnic and religious divides, with poverty, terror, and growth, always growth. It's a story that has significance, too, for how urban families everywhere must contend with changing times. The book is called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Steve Inskeep, co-host of Morning Edition, is the author, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the invitation.
Happy to have you here. I want to ask you first about what drew you to telling this particular story. You've reported from Pakistan, as we said in the introduction, many times. What was it that made you want to write this particular part of that story?
I think it grew on me, Dave, and this is really true of most of my reporting. I don't start with some kind of agenda, usually, or any particular definite idea of what I want, just some curiosity. And I was assigned to spend time in Pakistan after the 9/11 attacks. I covered the war in Afghanistan. Then in early 2002, I was in Pakistan, and I spent time in Karachi. The first story that I covered there actually was court proceedings relating to the killer of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter, which is the kind of thing that gives you a very negative view of a place. And I certainly did not like Karachi all that much at the beginning. It was just a really huge and hard to understand place. But I've always been interested in cities. And I appreciate that you mentioned in the introduction that this is not just about one city. It strikes me as the story, as a story that is almost a metaphor or a parable for how we all live in cities around the world, as well as being an example of very concrete trends of the way that cities are growing immensely. I mean, this is a city that was around 400,000 people when Pakistan became an independent country in 1947, and now has at least, by the most conservative estimate, 13 million. Phenomenal growth in this metropolitan area, and that's relatively normal around the world. And I wanted to understand better what was happening there.
And describe what that looks and feels like for a city to experience that kind of explosive growth.
You go around the city and you see phenomenal contrasts, phenomenal fault lines that represent some of the great issues of our time. You mentioned that in this story that I'm trying to go beyond terrorism and the things we normally hear about in Pakistan. There's plenty of terrorism in this book. If you're interested in terrorism, there will be some, because you don't get away from it in Pakistan right now. And that's one of the divides, religious divisions, religious conflicts. But there are other things as well. You go around the city and you can be near the beach or on the beach looking at glass office towers that are going up, Dubai-style developments and new shopping malls, because people are making a lot of money in this city. Even at this troubled time in a troubled country, there is a lot of conspicuous consumption. You can go elsewhere in the city and find these vast unauthorized neighborhoods where developers have grabbed hundreds of acres or even hundreds of square miles, many square miles at a time, chopped them up into tiny home lots and sold them to poor people who build these tiny concrete block houses on them. You have, the formal economy, the global economy working its way through Karachi, and you also have the informal economy and people subsisting on a couple of dollars a day.
You mentioned that question of land and these sort of
developments that spring up without a lot of clarity necessarily about whose land it even is.
Yeah.
And that's a phenomenon you see everywhere in the developing world.
Yeah, that is universal almost everywhere except, you know, Western Europe and the United States. I mean, you can go and think about the favelas, the famous favelas in Rio de Janeiro. That's basically what they are. You can go to Bogota, Colombia, as I did a number of years ago. And there's this area that a gentleman took me to visit some people once called Ciudad Bolivar. And it is on the mountains outside of Bogota, and it's said to be something like 1 million people in the neighborhood, and it's all considered to be an unauthorized settlement. This is normal all around the world.
I did some reporting from Port-au-Prince after the earthquake, and one of the big handicaps to how that area is going to recover is that question of no one knows even whose land it is.
Yeah.
And yet, what you also hear when you're in a place like Port-au-Prince, and it sounds like what you also discovered in Karachi, is that it's still the best place to be. It may be horrible, but it's better than being anywhere else.
Dave, that's one of the most important things to understand about our world right now. These giant cities are so frightening. They're so dirty. They suck up so many resources. They cause so many problems. And yet, to many of the people who go to them, they're a solution. And the very reason the city grows is because it's better than the poor village or the natural disaster or whatever it was that people came from.
Steve Inskeep, the book Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. He'll be at Book Passage, by the way, in Corte Bandeira tonight at 7 o'clock if you're interested in meeting Steve and hearing more about this story. You build the book in part around a religious procession called the Ashura, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, exactly.
And the event that took place with the Ashura on December the 28th of 2009, when during that procession a bomb went off, a number of people were killed. What is it about that moment and that event that you think is so iconic, I guess, about what Karachi is contending with?
Well, I felt that it was a day in the life of the city that everybody remembered that revealed so many of the fault lines in this city. And let's think about what some of those dividing lines are. You have global versus local. You have rich versus poor, insiders versus outsiders, majority faiths versus minority religious beliefs, newcomers versus old-timers. And in this case, you had a minority sect, the Shias, who were attacked, which is very ordinary, actually, in Karachi and across Pakistan, and reminds me that a lot of this war on terror that we think of as sometimes as being Islam versus the West, that's not really what the conflict is. It's actually a conflict among Muslims in which we are often caught.
You describe it as an atrocity stage for a local audience.
Exactly, and that's what it was. Americans barely noticed. December 28th, 2009, think about that. Do you remember anything about this? I mean, this is the holiday season in the United States. We were obsessed, actually, with another crime, the so-called underwear bomber who had tried to bomb a plane on Christmas Day. And we weren't thinking about it at all in the United States. But there was this tragedy there, and it was Muslims attacking Muslims. And it was only the beginning of the violence of that day. There were other acts as well that reveal some of these fault lines.
One of the things that I got from that story and from what else you point out in the book is that homogeny of religion doesn't necessarily lead to stability. You make the argument that, in fact, Karachi was a more stable place when it once had a larger Hindu population.
Yeah, it was a majority Hindu city when Pakistan became independent in 1947. 51%, an incredibly diverse place, about 40-some percent Muslim, and there were a bunch of other religious faiths, a bunch of other faiths represented as well. And after partition, when you had British India divided into majority Hindu India and majority Muslim Pakistan, the Hindus, the overwhelming majority of them, fled Karachi or were driven out. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of Muslim refugees arrived in Karachi from India. The city, on balance, actually grew phenomenally in the course of a few years. And you're exactly right. It went from being this really diverse place to a place that was well over 90% Muslim, where in theory everybody was the same. But it became, and you would think that would make it a simpler place to live and a more stable place to live. But it became less stable as it became less diverse, because that that sameness of everyone was really only on the surface. There's an incredible variety of Muslim belief in Pakistan. There's an incredible variety of languages, of backgrounds, of ethnicities, and all these other divisions caused people in different ways to... People began finding new divisions among themselves to argue about, even arguing over who got to be counted as a Muslim, for example.
And are there lessons within that to other instant cities around the globe and the way in which we contend with these forces that often divide us?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I end up in the course of the book quoting Mike Royko, the great Chicago newspaper columnist. American cities were often on my mind as I reported this city on the other side of the world. And it's not that our cities are the same, but there's something human about this process of people dividing up according to their background, according to their home country language, according to various customs, according to various tribal impulses, if you want to call it that. And Royko writes about how Chicago, up until the 1950s and to a lesser extent in years afterward, people clustered in their various ethnic neighborhoods and you couldn't cross a certain street or you couldn't cross a certain railroad track because that was somebody else's neighborhood and they'd throw bricks at you. He describes it as almost like a war zone in some cases. And you realize from examples like that that there is something universal about these kinds of divisions. The great strength of a city is its diversity, but the great challenge of a large city is also its diversity.
I thought about Phoenix some, which was also, you know, a pretty dusty small town after World War II, if you take that same time frame. And now it's increased 30-fold the way Karachi has, but it's – and now, as
it's
you
huge.
Mentioned in the book, the focus of so much of the debate now over diversity and immigration.
Yeah, no, it's huge. In 1950, Phoenix was 1/16th the size it is now as a metropolitan area. So that's pretty phenomenal growth. And you realize that means that there are 16 people for every one who is around, meaning that for virtually everyone alive in Phoenix, that landscape is new. People have moved from the south, from Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America, but they've also moved from the north to Phoenix, Anglos from all across the United States, and a degree of people from elsewhere in the world have moved to this landscape where the rules are still being written and where nothing is completely traditional or familiar. And so it seems natural to me that Arizona would become a center for the debate over questions like immigration, because nobody is entirely secure in a landscape like that.
You reference, I guess, the first president of Pakistan after independence, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and what he tried to do to sort of hold on to that diversity when Pakistan first became a state. And you quote him as saying, if you change your past and work together in a spirit that every one of you, no matter to what community he belongs, no matter what relations he has had in the past, no matter what his color, there will be in the end progress that you can make. It's sort of the Rodney King, can't we all get along, right? I mean,
I suppose so. I think it might have been a little more sophisticated than that. This guy was a brilliant British educated lawyer, the founder of Pakistan. And he was a guy who was a member of a minority Muslim sect himself. He was a Shia. People today would probably call him a secular kind of guy. But he was a Shia, and he had friends and relations and even a wife who belonged to other religious faiths entirely. And so he was someone who appreciated diversity and also realized that the new capital city of his country, which was going to be Karachi in 1947, was a majority Hindu place where the elites tended not to be Muslims. The Hindus were more educated. They had more money. They had more human capital. They had more actual capital. They had resources that Jinnah wanted for his new country. And it was in many ways a tragedy for that country that the Hindus left. And an occasion, when you read Jinnah's speeches, an occasion for bitterness. I mean, the Hindus would say that they were driven out, and there are documented cases of riots and people's houses being looted and so forth in Karachi. And of course, there were many, many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands killed elsewhere in Pakistan outside of Karachi. But Jinnah felt that the minorities had not given him a chance to prove what he said. And he was kind of bitter about it in some of his statements. And the country has struggled ever since to deal with the wounds of that time. At the same time, people remember this speech that you just read from, in which Jinnah said that people should overlook color, caste, or creed. a pretty advanced speech to give in 1947. And it's something that Pakistanis have struggled and often not succeeded to live up to ever since.
You also reference someone in the book who says that Jinnah once said to him that every government of Pakistan will be worse than the one that preceded it. Has that played out, and to what extent has that meant that his dream hasn't been fulfilled?
Oh, well, you know, I would put it a little differently than Jinnah's forecast, but not optimistically necessarily. What has happened in Pakistan, and I think it's really revealing about how you get ahead in the world and how you develop a country and how you don't, is that each government of Pakistan has started over from scratch. And what I mean by that is you have a few years of ineffective democracy, then someone gets frustrated and there is a coup, a military coup. Then the dictator starts over again, redoes the constitution, redoes the basic laws, tries to build a political system. After a few years, there is protest against the dictator and he's thrown out or he dies. And so then they start over a third time with democracy, which again causes frustration, and they start over again with a military coup. It's been a constant process of starting over and over again. And many, many people make the contrast with India right next door, fundamentally the same people, same part of the world, and terrible, terrible problems in governing, terrible corruption, terrible ineffectiveness, crumbling infrastructure, and yet India has maintained some form of democracy since independence, and India has had the breathing space to make progress economically.
But as you also point out, part of the reason for that may be is that India had a built-in infrastructure left over from the British colonial times. Pakistan was starting from scratch from the get-go.
Yeah, the Indians certainly did, and I think that that was true physically and also emotionally. Let me tell you what I mean by that. In a physical sense, India got the old British capital, got the old buildings, got the old colonial infrastructure, the old infrastructure of government. And Pakistan had to make up these things. Actually, in the city of Karachi, beginning in the 1940s, Karachi had been a provincial capital, and even that not for very long. And so they had to start very much from scratch. Emotionally, I think the same thing was true. And it's worth thinking about because it says a lot about the trouble that the United States is dealing with when we think about this ally. India, just because of the name India, is able to lay claim to this ancient civilization. And Indians know what their country is about. Pakistanis are part of that same tradition and are aware of it, but have struggled much more to answer the question what their country is about. And for some people, it is about religion. And that has caused grave trouble. For other people, it is about other things, and there's a constant struggle to define the country.
Help use that context, then, to explain why, you know, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was just in recently making one of our recurring and periodic pitches about how Pakistan has to get tough on terror. Is this country and lurching from one government to the next and everything that you describe about its history and the contrasting forces that define it part of why it's so hard to make the sale?
Yeah, I mean, that is part of it. Part of it is the politics in Pakistan are so difficult, so challenging. There is a degree of anti-Americanism, a great frustration and suspicion of the United States, especially in the Pakistani media. Even though people on a basic level are friendly to you when you visit, there's great suspicion of the United States and hostility. And that makes it politically difficult for the Pakistani government to cooperate with the United States, even if they want to. Sometimes they do cooperate. For example, there's a lot of evidence that the Pakistani government is okay with those drone strikes that the U.S. does, that they think they're just fine. But they'll never say that because they're unpopular. And so they don't build public support for it. Now, Secretary Clinton was asking about another issue having to do with this Haqqani network, this group of militants that is said to take shelter on Pakistani soil. And the Pakistanis, for a variety of reasons, haven't gone after them. Some of them, in fairness, may be practical. It takes a lot of troops to do counterinsurgency, and the Pakistanis are already tied down with so many other insurgencies. But some of it also may have to do with perceptions of their national interests. The Pakistanis are thinking about India, which we mentioned a moment ago. It's their historic enemy. They fought repeated wars, and they see Afghanistan on the other side of Pakistan there, if you think about the map, as a place where those two countries battle out their respective interests. And the Pakistanis see the Haqqanis as part of that mix. And so it makes them reluctant to go and wipe out militant groups that may be useful later.
Steve Inskeep, again, our guest. The book, Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. He'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 o'clock. There's part of the story where you go in search of one of the first kind of built, newly created neighborhoods in Karachi. And explain some of that to us, because it's a bit of an archaeological mission. And it's an interesting story about the way in which cities grow and fold in on themselves and grow on top of each other again.
Well, thank you. It was an interesting story to pursue. In the 1950s and 60s, in the same era when vast suburbs were being built around American cities, there was a military ruler who brought in a great planner from outside to build vast suburbs around Karachi. Now, these were not middle-class suburbs as we came to know them here. These were suburbs designed to house hundreds of thousands of poor people, most of them refugees from that partition period that we described. And they were going to spread them out in this properly designed area outside of the city rather than crowding them in these illegal neighborhoods or illicit neighborhoods in the middle of the city. And what happened was that in spite of the effort to plan, the effort made no sense. You had people who were moved miles away from their jobs and made virtually no money and couldn't afford to commute back, couldn't afford bus fare or whatever it was going to be to go back. They ended up abandoning these homes that they had been given at a reduced price and going back into the city where they could be close to work. Then they moved factories out to the suburbs to get them closer to the people. But by then, the government housing program had broken down. There wasn't enough housing, and people began building unauthorized settlements just like the ones they had left in the center of the city. The incredible power of human nature overcame the best laid plans. And I think that that is classic. I think it's classic of cities around the world. Yeah. I think you could look in your neighborhood in this area and find subtle or not so subtle examples of that, where there are rules, where there are plans, but people bend them and push them and try to work things to their advantage. And in some ways, a great city like Karachi, or for that matter, a city like San Francisco, is a big lesson in unintended consequences.
At the end of the book, you go back to find that ideally planned neighborhood that you describe at the beginning.
It was erased.
And you say, on that street, I finally understood what happened to those ancient cities. This must have been roughly the way Babylon went underground and the way cities were layered on top of cities at Sirkap. Great empires buried by entropy, bad drainage, failure to clean the sewers, failure to pick up the garbage, failure to respect the common good, failure, in short, to find workable solutions to chronic problems.
Yeah, it was kind of moving in a way. I felt in that neighborhood that I was seeing these great historic forces which destroy cities over centuries, destroy this city, or a part of it anyway, in a matter of years, in a matter of decades. And it's exactly what you just said. The sewer clogs up, and so there's silt everywhere. There's garbage everywhere. In monsoon season, you get a lot of flooding. When the flooding recedes, the street is a little higher, and it gets higher and higher, and the houses actually begin to go underground, destroying these private properties because the public interest was not maintained.
Layers upon layers, and one of the layers, and we should speak to this when we return, that there it's still a city of great aspiration. And you profile many of those people who are climbing above those layers to try to sustain their own lives. We'll talk with Steve Inskeep about that when we return. We welcome your calls as well. Here's the number, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour is Steve Inskeep, the co-host of Morning Edition, of course, on NPR, and the author of a new book that's built out of his many reporting journeys to Pakistan. The book is called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Again, he'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight in Marin County, 7 o'clock this evening. One of the things that you also do in the book is profile people who are striving so hard to make it. It's really in many ways a story also about resilience. And I wanted to reference a couple of the people that you talked about.
Sure.
Towards the end of the book. There's a woman who's an architect who says at one point, I love my work, I love my family, I love my husband, I love my country, I love my city, but right now I want to change directions for the next 20 years of my life, and hopefully God will give me the next 20 years to do it. Did you find within all of that that we've been describing that as a constant theme as well, that push and aspiration for more?
Oh, yeah, it was huge. And it was huge among poor people who move from villages to work in a textile business for $3 or $4 a day and see that as an improvement. And you would find it also to a degree in the upper classes. And I guess the woman that you describe, a member of a wonderful couple, Adnan and Mahboob, Adnan Asdar and his wife Mahboob, she was an architect. She is an architect. He's effectively a builder. The head of a communications company that's involved in a lot of construction projects. And they both had made a lot of money. They both had been very successful. But exactly what you said, they wanted to do more for their community, and they were looking for a way. Now, that's not universal. There is, you know, great selfishness and greed in this city like any city we could mention in the world. And in fact, there's great concern in a city like this about the elites and the way that they can insulate themselves from the problems of the city by doing things like buying generators so that when the power goes out every right. single day, they don't have to worry about it. But this couple actually chose not to buy a generator.
Tell that story. Yeah, That's a really interesting story.
I'm sitting there. We're talking with them. It's the evening, and something happens that happens a lot, actually, in Karachi when you're talking to people. The power goes out, and you're in utter pitch darkness. And Mahboob says to the kids, go get the generator. But that's a family joke. They don't have a generator. They're going to go get candles and light them. They deliberately didn't buy one because they wanted to make sure that their kids were not insulated from the reality that so many millions of people are living today.
And that's juxtaposed with the reality of a golf course that's lit at night.
Yeah, yeah. The military has first call on many resources in Pakistan and has access to a great deal of land. And the military itself has become a land developer in many cities across the country. And that includes a peninsula of land near the waterfront, on the waterfront, actually, that's extraordinarily valuable, where apartment towers are going up, where a 6-star club, as it's described, has gone up. And yes, there's a golf course where, in the city that's short of electricity, they have lights that go on at night so that in the evenings, when it's a little cooler than during the day, people can play golf.
You quote Dwight Eisenhower in 1957 is commenting about military, and you quote Eisenhower as saying that the United States was, quote, doing practically nothing for Pakistan except in the form of military aid. That's the worst kind of plan and decision we could have made. It's really interesting, prescient, perhaps, comment. I know you don't opine on what sort of aid the U.S. ought to provide, but what do you make of that and the way in which we are tied to the military and in turn its role in Pakistan?
Well, Eisenhower's complaint was so interesting for the very reason you say. It happened in 1957, but you could have made the same complaint in 1987 or in 2007. Again and again, the United States, for understandable reasons, has reached out to a military ruler because they needed something out of Pakistan, and the military seemed to be the organized entity that could get things done, and the civilians did not. But, of course, that has encouraged long-term problems. It has strengthened an institution, the military, that is already overwhelmingly strong. It has weakened an institution, the civilian government, that we as Americans would like to think that we support. We'd like to think we support democracy, wouldn't we?
Did you come back, having just been there recently as a month ago, do you have a sense that we're not paying attention then to the right things? I mean, where do you...
Well, let's remember there's an effort, a struggle to pay attention to the right things and to rebalance that relationship that Eisenhower complained about so long ago. The Kerry Lugar bill, which will be familiar to people who follow these issues, was an effort to dedicate several billion dollars, not to military aid, on which we already spend many billions of dollars, several billion dollars for civilian projects. And actually, in some of our reporting earlier this year, we asked where some of that money was going. It turns out that it's very hard to spend it if you want to spend it the right way. You can give it to a giant American contractor to go in and start building a bunch of schools. But we tried that in Iraq. It didn't work out very well. A lot of money was wasted. A lot of the projects were never completed. They seemed to make no sense. In Pakistan, they're attempting to do what's called capacity building, train people to get them in position to properly account for the money, to properly spend the money. That slows things down, and the politics slow things down. Some Pakistani government entities have been talking about and even actively refusing American aid, saying we don't like the strings attached. We don't like the raid on into the country that killed bin Laden. You didn't tell us you were doing that. We don't like a lot of your policies, and we don't like being bought off with this aid.
Let's hear what our listeners would like to ask. We're joined first by Rachel today in Sebastopol. Rachel, go ahead, please.
Hi there.
Go ahead. Rachel. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm curious to have Mr. Inkeep follow up on his statement that India is benefits from the name India and the history and what all was the Aryan peace there. And how important is it for Pakistanis to either find their own claim to that rich history, which is theirs, or if there's something else that is more important that looking forward. And I'm just curious to hear you speak more to that, please.
Well, I think of the name as kind of shorthand for this whole large problem. Indians seem to have found a working definition of who they are as a multi-religious country. And of course, it's Hindu majority and Hindu-dominated. They're Hindu nationalist parties. What I'm saying is approximate and imperfect. But there is a sense of a great civilization there. And even though Pakistan has an equal claim, a fair claim to a slice of that history, it doesn't have the name. And it doesn't have the great bulk of the population, and that has made it difficult. And Pakistanis, from that very moment that we described earlier of the founder of Pakistan, talking about a state that respected people regardless of color, caste, or creed, from that very moment, there's been arguments about what the country is supposed to be about and, in fact, efforts to rewrite history. Last year in Lahore, I was talking with a leader of this Islamist student organization who told me that actually what Jinnah really wanted was a conservative Muslim state ruled by Sharia, Islamic law. So people have taught themselves non-factual history, and they argue over the basic meaning of the country. Think of what a value it is to us in the United States, just to, even though we disagree so profoundly on so much right now, at least we basically agree that we're a democracy and that that's a good thing and that's the way it ought to be and that it's ruled by the... There are a few basic things, even in this deeply divided time, that we agree on. And it's harder to find that basic agreement in Pakistan right now.
Although, you know, I was thinking when you were saying before about how every government almost starts anew in Pakistan, ripping up the old constitution, doing something new. That while we're obviously not at that point in this country, we are sort of lurching to another, from one change election, as they're called, to the next, and back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, I think that people outside the country, when you read commentaries outside the United States, they're not sure what to make of us right now, because we seem to go one way in 2008, another way in 2010, and we don't know where we're going for 2012.
866-733-6786 is the number. If you have a question for Steve Inskeep, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Shabab joins us next from Manchester, New Hampshire. Shabab, go ahead, please. Are you with us, Shabab? Okay, try calling us back. Sorry, we'll get to his call later. Let's go to Paul next in San Jose. Or we're not quite ready with Paul either, so we'll get to that in just a moment. Now we've got you, Paul. Go ahead. Paul, you're on the air. Yep, go ahead, Paul.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Okay.
I'm glad that you spent a good amount of time in Pakistan and tried to learn their civilization. Let me tell you one thing. It's not the people, it's the politics both in India and Pakistan that has made the whole civilization worse. All people are very hardworking. They are very down to earth. They love everything. They love humanity. They love each other. But it's the politics that have made them be like that. It's not the people, but it's the poor and corrupt politics in both the countries that has let down the whole thing, whole democracy down.
Thanks.
May I ask, are you Pakistani?
No, I'm not Pakistani. I'm a human being. I'm from India, but I'm a human being. I don't believe in any religion, because everybody has misinterpreted the word religion.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think that's a useful observation. And yeah, when you get down to the ordinary people in Pakistan, it's like anywhere else. It's different than the politicians. There's another way to think of it also. There's a struggle between the ordinary people and the elites. And yeah, I mean, there's a case to be made that the ordinary people are leading more honest lives and more straightforward lives than the elites. If you see it from the elites' point of view, they might say that they have more sympathy with the West, but they have to struggle constantly with this uneducated population that can be manipulated by clerics and by extreme ideas from time to time. There's some merit in both those claims, but there's even one more thing to say, which is that the vast mass of Pakistanis appears to be fundamentally tolerant, fundamentally open to different points of view, but there are large and growing groups of extremists who have more and more influence.
Paul, thanks for the call. Here's an emailed in, or web comment rather. Karachi is sometimes called the Bombay of Pakistan. How would you compare Karachi with the city of Lahore and the capital city of Islamabad?
Well, now that's interesting, all those comparisons. Bombay, or Mumbai as it is now formally called, has many of the same problems that Karachi does. There's a lot of ethnic politics, there's a lot of crime, there's a lot of unauthorized use of land, tremendous population growth. But of course, Bombay is seen as a city on the way up. Karachi has many of the advantages that Bombay or Mumbai does, but is seen as a city on the way down. Hmm. And that's because the law and order situation is even worse, and the rule of law is even worse than you would find it in Mumbai. Now, you asked for a comparison with a couple of other Pakistani cities. Lahore is another really large city, not as big as Karachi, growing very rapidly, a little more culturally cohesive, simply because it is the center of this vast province called Punjab, which the majority of migrants to Lahore come from. And so there's just not quite as much diversity. Islamabad is a city that was created out of thin air, kind of like Washington was once upon a time, or like Brasilia was in the same era in the 1950s, 1960s. It was designed by the same planner who tried and failed to reshape Karachi. Islamabad worked out a little bit better, but you see some of the same problems creeping in there as that really powerful capital city grows and grows beyond its plans.
You've observed once that Karachi is sort of, you think of it as kind of a listening post for a global conversation. Is Karachi, despite all of its problems, in the end, though, therefore more interesting than Islamabad
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, if you need to know what government insiders are doing, you want to go to Islamabad because that's where they are. But if you want to get a sense of where the man on the street is going, the largest number of men on the street, or women on the street for that matter, will be found in Karachi. It's the economic heart of Pakistan. And it is, as I said, it's a representative of so many other cities around the world.
And to Anji next in San Francisco. Anji, go ahead, please. Anji, are you with us? Do you want to go ahead?
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question. You spoke a little bit earlier about Jinnah wanting to keep the minorities and feeling disgruntled that they didn't give him a chance.
Yeah.
But wasn't the whole point of partition for Pakistan to have an Islamic state? And
the
majority Islamic?
You hit on one of the great contradictions of history in South Asia and one of the great difficulties that this man Jinnah faced.
And again, if you weren't with us for the first part of our conversation, first leader of Pakistan after independence.
Exactly. And of course, Pakistan and India were both given their independence at the same time upon the division of what was then British India in 1947. Jinnah argued that he did not want an exclusively Muslim state. What he wanted was political rights for people who were Muslim. He argued that the Muslims were a separate nation, in effect, almost like their own ethnic group, and that they should be led by him and that they should have equal political rights to the Hindus, even though the Hindus were far more numerous the solution that ultimately came about was slicing it up into two different political states. It's possible then to say that Jinnah is a hypocrite, a great historic hypocrite. Why did he go through with this division, knowing that he actually wanted something else, really a different kind of society? But I wonder if actually another way to think of it is just that he was a brilliant lawyer, he was a brilliant mind, he was a brilliant political tactician, and he ended up trying to draw really fine distinctions that were hard for the people in the street to understand, hard for them to bear.
David has a question from our website that also refers back to that time of division and the ongoing tension between India and Pakistan. He writes in, other than the dispute over Kashmir, how are India and Pakistan's interests divergent today? India has a very successful economy and democracy. Pakistan is essentially a failed state. Would it be in the best interest of both parties to settle that dispute and work together? It's not as if India wants to restore its pre-partition territory.
I think that it's widely understood by elites on both sides of the border that, yes, settling disputes with India would be great for both countries and especially good for Pakistan. There's an effort right now to do a trade agreement. It doesn't seem that large, but there are efforts to do things. It is widely understood that Pakistan's trouble stems from that dispute with India. It's one of the reasons they have to have such a large and powerful military. It's one of the reasons the economy has not grown as much. They don't have full access to this vast and growing, rising Indian economy. They could be making a lot of money in greater trade. But each time there's been an effort to resolve differences, somebody seems to torpedo it. Most recently, and I'm stitching together things that you can't prove are connected, but in 2007 or so, Pervez Musharraf, the last military ruler of Pakistan, was having very quiet talks with India to try to begin to resolve disputes along the border. And it was, of course, in 2008, if I'm not mistaken, that there was an attack on Mumbai by people from Pakistan, which poisoned the political atmosphere. The two countries didn't go to war in the end, but that terrorist attack made it impossible, politically impossible for a while for them to make progress. Now they've begun in a very small way to try again.
Steve Inskeep, again, our guest. His book, Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Still time to join us, if you'd like, at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And to Kisa next in Fremont. Kisa, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling because, you know, I was married to a Pakistani man from Karachi, and he was pretty liberal as far as religion goes. And this is related to the last two questions. He was really of the opinion. He used to lament a lot the progress that India had made, you know, in comparison to Pakistan. And he really kind of chalked that up to the religious isolation and just the fact that India had this diversity and had accepted multiple, you know, religions, and that kind of made them more appealing to the West and just better able to embrace more worldwide economy and things like that. And I was just wondering if Mr. Inskeep, if he found support for that idea actually in Pakistan, or if he could weigh in on that idea himself.
I think that is something that you do hear Pakistanis say. They look and they make this comparison, and how could they not? That is their enemy in repeated wars. And India seems to be going so well, and the Pakistanis, because of the recent history, have cut themselves off from one of the great economic stories of the last century. I think there's a lot of Pakistani curiosity about India. Hmm. I met so many Pakistanis in my visits who had gone to India, who wanted to go to India, who were planning to go to India. I presume that Indians also are curious and like to go the other way. I know that books about Pakistan become bestsellers in India. There is a lot of curiosity and interest because people understand that in many ways it is one people with a dividing line between them.
Is there a place within the dialogue that goes on in Pakistan now for someone to make that argument?
To make that argument to
politically? Is there a capacity now for someone to lead in that direction?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there are possibilities, and as I said, they make announcements. They made an announcement about a trade deal just a few weeks ago. There are talks from time to time, but again and again they've been sabotaged because a minority group that's willing to use violence can or political populism can whip up opposition very quickly.
Kisa, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Noel in Menlo Park. Noel, go ahead, please.
Yes. So my question is about Pakistan and its nuclear weapons. But before I ask the question, it's my thought that we need to be out of Afghanistan and we should have much less of a presence in Pakistan and should fund them at a much lesser level, and that the main concern that Pakistan has is primarily with India. So with that said, however, what I'm concerned about is the nuclear weapons that Pakistan has and whether or not, or what you would suggest the United States involvement should be there relative to our concern about their nuclear weapons.
Well, I think that it is a little challenging for the United States on a practical basis to give that much help to the Pakistanis with just securing their nuclear weapons. If you're worried about a nuclear weapon being stolen, the Pakistanis actually at this moment are paranoid. And I speak broadly, a number of Pakistanis, including a lot of the military, are paranoid that the United States is plotting to take their nuclear weapons. There are theories in the media that the terrorist attacks in Pakistan are actually perpetrated by the Americans as a plot to destabilize the country, so there is an excuse to take the nuclear weapons. So this is not an atmosphere in which it's easy for the United States to reach out and help the Pakistanis secure them. With that said, I think that it's worth paying attention to some of these other issues having to do with the stability of the country, the governance of the country, the literacy rate of the country, long-term issues, because if you have a stable and prosperous country, you probably have to worry less about who's got their finger on the nuclear button of that country.
Noel, thanks for the call. I want to come back in our last few minutes to the story of Karachi itself and how it will continue to grow, because that's the one thing we know, that it will continue to grow, and what you see as the prospects for it. You talk to a young man towards the end of the book, Amar, I think, and you quote him as saying, "If you come to Karachi for a few days, you will hate it. But if you come to Karachi for 40 days, you will love it and never want to leave."
Yeah. He's a young man who worked with me. He worked with me as an interpreter and in some other ways. And he had come from a small rural village himself out in the province of Sindh, of which Karachi is the capital. He spoke an obscure regional language as a small child, then learned Sindhi, the language of the province, later learned Urdu, which is the most widely spoken language in Pakistan, and finally learned English, which is seen as a passkey to the global economy. So this is a guy that clearly had a lot of desire to learn. And he moved to Karachi, and in spite of all the hardship and difficulty of living there, seemed to really embrace and love the city, and worked as a journalist there, continues to work as a journalist there. And you find this kind of eagerness to embrace the city an awful lot. It's like the New York of Pakistan. I'm not the first person to make that observation.
So what does...
Well, let's say the San Francisco of Pakistan, shall we? I think that would be better, wouldn't it?
What does, in the end, Karachi have to tell us about the way in which cities will continue to grow? If it is a listening post for a global conversation, what is it that we ought to hear coming out?
Well, let's note that the United Nations contends that next week we'll have 7 billion people in the world and that population is continuing to grow. The most spectacular expression of that population is these instant cities, which have sprung up especially since the end of World War II. They will continue to grow, and they are spectacular expressions of problems. Conflicts, the fault lines we've been talking about between different kinds of people, shortages of resources, enormous pollution. What we can hope is that these cities are also solutions to the problems that they represent or the problems that they cause. The great urban writer Jane Jacobs, in one of her books called The Economy of Cities, pointed out that cities are centers of innovation, centers of thought, that it actually was in cities that people figured out the technology to improve agriculture so that more people in the world could be fed. And so we can hope that even though there are terrible problems in the rapidly growing cities of the world, that there is also can also be innovation that will resolve those problems over time.
What did it teach you?
You know, it just reminded me to go back and look a little more deeply at the news. I mean, this is a country, as you pointed out, that I've covered for a while. I observe the headlines when I'm not there. Frequently, the headlines make absolutely no sense. And I felt that I began to learn some of the trends that made those headlines make sense and made the global economy a little more comprehensible to me. And above all, I was just reminded to listen to the stories of people that I meet. I learned so much just from people that I meet on the street, and that was certainly true of this book. And there are people, ordinary people throughout this book. Their stories make this book. It's their story, really.
You tell one of those stories at the end that I'd like you to tell us as we end our hour. Tell us about the birds.
Oh, yeah. In Karachi, if you drive around, you may see at a street corner boys in traffic selling birds. They've got little nets. They may have some extra birds in a cage off to the side. And they're just little birds. And if a driver is having a bad day or a bad life, they'll roll down the window or get out of the car and pay the boy some money. And having collected that ransom, the boy will set the bird free. It is a quasi-religious practice. People seemed a little unclear on where it came from. Hindus and Muslims alike seemed to do it.
And you did it.
I just decided I should do this and see what it's like. So I stopped over and met one of these young men. He was a poor Hindu, an obviously poor Hindu with basically a pollution-colored outfit from standing in traffic. And he sold me four birds for 100 rupees, a little more than a dollar. And he took them out of the cage one by one. He put it in my palm. I just kind of sat there with the bird. Each bird just kind of bounced off my palm like it was a diving board and flew away. I don't think I was doing it right. He didn't look impressed. And then the last one, I'm not sure, am I supposed to cup the bird? Am I supposed to say a prayer? I don't know. I'm just a guy doing this to see what it's like. And the last bird he put on, and I've got a photo of this, he put on my palm and it settled in like it didn't realize that it was free. And finally, I gave it a little push or something, and it flew up into a darkening sky and out of sight.
Steve Inskeep, the book Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Pleasure to have you on our program.
Thanks for the invitation.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. If you'd like to hear Steve Inskeep, he'll be at Book Passage tonight at Corte Madera at 7 o'clock. This evening. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.